this experience of this whole new life we're living has been very powerful for me. I've had a really amazing experience to reset, recalibrate, take inventory, get surrendered, and adjust myself to new conditions, which I don't like doing, but I have found magic in that. You know, I've gone to much more meetings. I've had some really great sponsorship experiences, staying active with the people that I sponsor on the phone. Get to hear my first fifth step on Zoom tomorrow. I'm super excited about that. And I just don't feel like I'm missing much. I mean, I miss giving people hugs and seeing people in the meetings and going to my home group church, but the way that little dank basement smells, but you know, at least we're all still together. And I love AA for that. I love alcoholics. And, I'm kind of grateful to be one. I'm very grateful to be one now. Glad I found you guys. Sarah and I are very similar. I have a tendency to talk fast. I mean, you guys got two women that are cut from a very similar cloth. I too was a teenage alcoholic. I also am sponsored, thank God. I have a sponsor who's very aware that she's my sponsor. I'm actively sponsoring other members in AA. And my life is one of service today, which is not something I ever thought I would want. And it's, ironically, the best thing that's ever happened to me. my sobriety date is September 1st, 1994. That was my mom's 40th birthday. And I remember making a decision that, I mean, it was already made for me. I was rolling around on step one for years before I made the decision to finally really and truly try to turn my will and my life over to yet another doctor, yet another hospital, yet another rehab, and then ultimately to you guys. And it was my mom's 40th birthday, and I remember having a sense that I was I had a sense that my alcohol problem was gonna be relieved, because I made the decision, like, I cannot stay stopped on my own. I am desperate to get out of this life. I don't know what it means. And just like Sarah said, you know, I was out of ideas. I had no more options to turn. I'd tried everything to figure out how to control and enjoy my drinking, except for sobriety. And I was so sick of myself and so sick of my life and the person I'd become. I just couldn't even recognize myself anymore. I hated the person I was. And I said, you know, it was my mom's 40th birthday, and I checked myself and I went to a hospital and I checked myself into rehab, and I haven't had a drink since. And so that date has been very sacred to me. And even though there's been dark times like Sarah shared about, that thought of that date has kept me on the path somehow. It's funny how God works. I got drunk for the first time by myself, very much like Sarah. I could totally relate to her. I had no idea how similar we were. Both teenage alcoholics. I got drunk at my dad's house on red wine, cheap red wine. Didn't even know, never drank wine with a cork, still haven't. Screw off bottle top, green easy red wine, had two big cups of it. I was probably 10 years old at my dad's house. And I felt the effects produced by alcohol. And before that time, by 5 years old, I was a stressed out, nervous, anxious child. My parents divorced when I was 4, and from like birth to 4, I was living this magical, I mean, I was loved. I had both my parents living together. I didn't know what their marriage looked like, but it wasn't great. I didn't know that. I mostly spent my time at the babysitter's house next door, who was literally like an angel, this woman and her husband. They just loved and adored me. And I spent most of my time with them when my parents worked, and my grandparents lived down the street, and they would come see me a couple times a week. I just had all this love and all this safety and security. And before my mom's and dad's marriage broke up. And at that time, my life broke apart and I started crying. I remember, my mom will probably remember this. She's on the call now. She's actually a member of Al-Anon, and she was supposed to come up with me, and we were going to meet. She was in North Carolina. We were going to meet up in y'all's town and spend the weekend together. What an amazing gift that is. But anyway, after they divorced and my mom remarried, I started feeling anxious. I started getting stomach aches. I was full of anxiety. I didn't know what that was at the time, but I thought it was a stomach ache, but really it was anxiety. It was fear. It was insecurity. It was the feeling that something was wrong with me. I was the only person I knew that had divorced parents at that time. I hated that my dad, that everybody was far away, and I was all alone. I just felt really alone. I was the only child, probably contributed, definitely contributed to my self-centeredness. And my little world just broke apart and I started crying. And I cried for about a year, every single day. I just sobbed and sobbed and sobbed and grieved that change. And I got my first resentment at 4. I resented my mother for leaving my dad. And it was, I was angry. And anger started, right? That's how I react. Very much like Sarah. God, I can relate to her so much. By the time I was 10 years old, my mom had the dining room table was full of all the broken phones. Like I would have a rage fit on the phone. I'd get a busy signal or somebody would hang up on me or something would happen that didn't go my way. And I would take that phone and slam it against the wall. And now this is back in the day when you had cords and phones on the wall. And I would just beat the phone apart until it broke. I mean, just so angry, so much anger in me. And so when I found booze and I found the effects produced by alcohol in my dad's house by myself, I knew intuitively that this was going to be something I was going to do for the rest of my life. Like I understood why the adults drank. I felt at perfect peace and ease. I felt the fears fall for me. I felt the nearness of my creator. I had my first spiritual experience when I got loaded and I could not wait to do it again. And as a teenage alcoholic, a lot like Sarah, I was doing a lot of shoplifting, a lot of saving my lunch money, doing side jobs to make money, sometimes legal, sometimes not legal, and would squirrel away my money and just get loaded. That's all I wanted to do. Swim team, back burner. That used to be my thing. Working out, going to swim team, being in gymnastics or whatever. Well, actually, I only did that for a little while, but swim team was important to me and going to the pool was important to me. And I stopped doing all that and started, you know, getting drunk at rock quarries and jumping off cliffs and, you know, taking acid. And there was no more but hanging out at the pool. It was all about getting loaded. And I was, I come from a long line of alcoholics. I'm not sure if it's genetic or not, but my soil was fertile. You put booze in me and I just lit up and I loved it. It let me come out and play, man. I was scared. I was a scared, nervous kid. And when I got loaded, I just wasn't afraid. I would talk you into skipping school with me. I would, you know, talk you into getting hitchhiking. I used to hitchhike all over the place. I would, talk you into stealing school buses. You know, that stealing the school bus thing. That landed me in my first rehab at 13. And my mom, right before I went into that rehab, she put me there. I was not even interested at all, but she had found Jesus and my life started getting downhill because now my mom is totally lit up and she's totally changing and she's joined a church and she's right with God and she's getting those intuitive tugs to read my journals and that something's wrong with her daughter and she starts trying to help and fix me. And she spent every dime that I can't even imagine how much money I'll never be able to repay, the amount of rehab. She put me in 5 or 6 rehabs. I was in 6 before I finally got sober. The last one I put myself in, but the other 5, she put me in, paid for, you know, anything to get me sober. And I went to my first AA meeting at 13 and I was, you know, not interested at all. I couldn't imagine enjoying my life sober. I just couldn't imagine. And I ended up getting sober at 18 years old. I had my last drink. It was by myself. My first drink, I was by myself. And like I said, I couldn't recognize the person I'd become. I just hated myself. Sarah talked about living like a squatter. I actually was a squatter. That's how I got around. I hitchhiked. I like lived in abandoned houses at the end. You know, nothing was sacred anymore. Every line that I thought I had about what kind of adult or kind of person I wanted to become. And I crossed all those things off the table and settled just for hitchhiking and trying to stay drunk every single waking moment. And it had long stopped working. Like I, you know, very similar to Sarah who shared before, man, I could not figure out how to drink and function. I couldn't do both. I chose to just be homeless and I was okay with that. Today as a sober person, I can't imagine sleeping in a tent or sleeping in a sleeping bag or sleeping in an abandoned house with bugs. Like all that just sounds crazy, you know, to me. That just not interested. But as a drunk person, I am fine with living like that. That's how much alcohol changed me. And booze was making decisions for me way, way, way before I thought it was. You know, my mom could see it because she wasn't in there inside me. I just thought I was changing my mind. I just thought I wanted to party and have fun. But really, booze was already calling the shots, like way, way before I ever really realized it was happening. And, you know, I get into AA at 18 years old and I am beaten. I had been beaten into a state of, I hate myself. I can't do this anymore. I don't want to live like this. I'm willing, if I have to join my mom's church and get my tattoos removed and wear pantyhose and flats and go to Sunday school, to not live this way, I'm willing to do it. I have that much, like that much. I'm grateful that AA is, you know, the God that I've been able to find in Alcoholics Anonymous is just so huge and big and so not that simple. You know, it's so much bigger and more powerful and more beautiful. But I didn't know that. I had a lot of old ideas about God. I brought a lot of fear in about God. You know, I was just certain that I was unholy, you know, that I was broken. And I carried that, those thoughts in with me for many, many years. And, you know, I got sober. I got physically sober and things started getting good for me. The anger was still there. I had not taken inventory. I got a sponsor in the beginning. I chose her to be my sponsor because she did some of the outside issues that I also did. And she was a homeless bag lady and I was a homeless bag lady. And I thought this would be a good sponsorship for sober a while. But the sponsorship, you know, I wouldn't allow people to help me. And that's the reality is that I keep people at arm's length and it works. It works in AA. It works outside of AA. But to not let somebody come in here, come into me and get close to me and get quiet with me and help. I wasn't ready. I was not quite convinced that my life run on my will wasn't going to be successful. And I needed to basically pile drive my life into the ground, with many years of sobriety to finally get the fact that, that those pertinent ideas, those three pertinent ideas that, I'm alcoholic and can't manage my own life, drunk or sober, that probably no human power could relieve me of my alcoholism, drunk or sober, and that God couldn't would if he were sought. And, I did not like the God idea because I thought there were things about me that made me unlovable. You know, I believed a lot of some of the press that I would hear. And, you know, I didn't need much help hating myself. I already had that pretty firm, that firm relationship with myself. So it didn't really take much for me to glom onto the, to that lower power way of thinking and glob onto the depressive and the, lonely and the martyr, you know, and the self-pity place. And that's what I did. And I didn't know I was doing that because I didn't let anybody get close to me enough to help me. I had, at 17 years sober is when I had my Bill Wilson white light moment. You know, that's, you know, I'm, my message is one that you can teach old dogs new tricks in AA, and that, that the room of the spirit is all inclusive and huge, and there's so many levels left to go. You know, that's what I found in my journey in Alcoholics Anonymous. But I hung out in AA and I did the walls up the step wall, like the steps on the wall by looking at them. I never actually read the book too much or, you know, wrote things down or talked to a sponsor with any kind of consistency. As a matter of fact, I thought, you know, this is my delusional thinking that, it, you know, it says it right in the fourth step in the big book. Like, I could not see that problems were my own making. I could not see that. I could not reveal self to self. Like, I could not see that I would ask somebody to be my sponsor and then I would just stop participating in that relationship. And then I would turn it around because I'm a keen alcoholic with a keen alcoholic mind and I would blame it on them. It's them. It's their way of doing AA, you know, that I'm not sitting with, or it's their schedule. You know, it was never, what I wasn't doing. I had no ability to see my part in anything because, again, I did not follow the directions outlined in this book. And I saw other people doing that in AA, and I just hated them. I just didn't like those people that were lit up and happy. You know, people that had contentment and peace and serenity. I just couldn't relate to them. I was still so angry, so full of self-pity, so full of self-centeredness, so full of old ideas. Like, I couldn't. There was no room for a God there, even if I could have prayed, which after about 2 or 3 years of sobriety, I kind of stopped praying, right? Because I didn't need God anymore. I was physically sober. I was making a living. You know, I was full of fear all the time about money, full of fear about everything. I didn't know that was killing me and keeping me sick. But I was keeping God at arm's length. I was keeping AA at arm's length. I would come to meetings because I knew I needed them. And I always felt God in a meeting. I, like Sarah, I could totally relate to feeling, remembering y'all's home group, and with fondness of the opportunity I got to speak there one Sunday many years ago and how it's just made an impact on me ever since. You can feel God in the rooms. And I always knew that. I always knew that AA was a sacred space, that it helped drunks and it changed people's lives and there were hope there. And I would go to a meeting and I would take a little sip of that hope. And then I go back in the rest of the world and run the show. And, I really had to get hurt. You know, I had to just be so sick of myself again, very much like the bottom of my drinking and drugging. I had to get beaten into a state of like, yo, God is either everything or God is nothing. What is your choice to be? You know, and intuitively, you know, I didn't pray when I was drinking. Obviously, I didn't pray much. Some people did. Occasionally I did. I mean, there were a couple, the only two times I really remember praying were, you know, waking up on an upside, you know, on the top of an upside down car inside and my head's on the light and I'm like, oh God, you know, my first thoughts, oh God, you know, the second time I remember praying was another, I'm definitely dying this time experience and oh God help me. You know, it was like intuitive that I would say those words when stuff got really bad. But I could not imagine a God personal to me, you know, that I talked to on a daily basis consistently throughout the day. I just couldn't imagine that. I heard people in AA talking about that kind of relationship and I just stuck in my judgment. I just believed that they were, you know, full of it or whatever. Somehow I was too broken to have that kind of relationship with a higher power. And anyway, my sobriety looked a lot like page 52 bedevilments. My sobriety looked a lot like, you know, depression, anxiety, discontent, irritable, restless, never satisfied. You know, you can get in that state stone cold sober, and that's how I lived, you know. I was still not drinking. I was still not living in abandoned houses. It was still better than what I had, you know, but I didn't know how much more AA could do. I didn't know how big this power was, and I didn't know what kind of life I could have if I could just get out of the way. And I ended up at a big book retreat. I'm dating a newcomer, 17 years sober. I'm dating a person with a year, maybe barely a year. I'm embarrassed by that. I'm ashamed of that. I've been around AA long enough to know that like, that's not good. You know, you might hurt somebody. Now, in fairness, she had a way better sobriety than me at that time. And she was going to that big book retreat. And so I went to that big book retreat and, I didn't even bring my book to the big book retreat. Like that's how asleep I was to what we were doing in here. But I showed up and I heard the message of Alcoholics Anonymous at that meeting. I heard hope. I heard contented sobriety. I heard about the power of the steps. I heard about this guy that chaired the meeting was just another alcoholic, like we all are just other alcoholics. He just shared his experience, and I related to him. He was a bank robber. He was insecure, small little guy. He made fun of himself a lot, and it was funny because he was free. You know, he's able to kind of laugh at his size and what a tough guy he tried to be out there and what prison was like. And then he cried and he talked about his wife and kids. He talked about his relationship with God as a result of AA. He talked about the change that came over him by working the steps and working with others. And I don't know. I just really related to that guy's Brian P from Texas. And, I'd never heard anybody break down the big book the way he did. I'd never seen it in practical terms of like an instruction manual. I just didn't participate like that. I didn't do it that way. And it just hit me in between the eyes. The very first night of that retreat, I felt God's presence in the room. I felt the power of God and I wanted it. I wanted anything more other than what I had. And what I had was discontented, untreated alcoholism, miserable, miserable sobriety. And, I'm so grateful that I went to that retreat. I'm so grateful because it's literally changed my life. It's been 8 years since that happened. And since that retreat happened, and the last day of the retreat, I ended up on my knees that Sunday morning, and they were, you know, it was like the last hour of the retreat. We were closing down, and I got on my knees, and I hadn't said a prayer like that in 15 years, 14 years. I mean, I just didn't pray at all. And I got on my knees and I begged God to change me. Like I got that everything that was wrong with my life was my fault. Like that I am just running the show and I don't know what the heck I'm doing. And I got to let this power in and I got to let somebody help me if I want to get different here. And I was so impressed by these men. It was mostly guys. They became my sponsorship family. I was so impressed with them because they were just happy guys. They were having a good time. They were bringing the message. They were solid, sober members of AA. They were the kind of people in AA that I would stay the hell away from because, I thought I was just too toxic and, too broken. And, you know, I got up off my knees on that and I cried, you know, an ugly prayer, like, please God, change me, like, change me, change me. I'd never uttered those words before, but I started to believe that God was big enough for a sick alcoholic like me from that retreat. I started to believe that, like, maybe, just maybe I was wrong, but I didn't know how wrong I had been. I was about soon to find out. There was a guy at the retreat. I got my first intuitive tug. God just was like, ask that guy to sponsor you. And I knew that he sponsored a lot of the men that had put on this retreat. And, you know, and I did some drugs and did some illegal things. And you always wanted to get to the better connection, right? Not the middleman. You wanted to get to the big guy, right? So I figured that the sponsors were like the middlemen and I should probably ask the big guy. You know, that's my rationale of this intuitive tug. But it turned out that Dave was the right guy for me. I didn't know he was the right guy for me. The thought of me asking him to sponsor me was, I couldn't believe it. I was like, really, God? Like, seriously, that guy? He's preppy. He's got, you know, khaki pants. He's like a wholesome, married, goes to church kind of guy. Like, I can't, you know. And I did. There was a part of me that was like, I'm pretty sure this guy's going to look at me and say, I don't sponsor toxic women in AA that have dreadlocks and are covered in tattoos, that have bad reputations. Like, I only sponsored winners. I really kind of thought he was going to say that, but I had just gotten up from this prayer and I felt this power surge of like willingness. And I ended up getting alone with him walking down to this Sunday morning thing and last workshop part. And I said, do you ever sponsor women? And he looked at me and said, well, yeah, lesbian women. And I just started sobbing again because I thought for sure that I was right, that everything I thought was right. And I never bounced off anybody else to know. I never even asked anybody questions to know. I was too afraid. I was too ashamed to even have a mind of my own or to even utter things that I were thinking because I just thought I was dumb or my pride would keep me from asking questions because I just needed you to think I knew something. You know, I didn't have any experience with sponsorship and yet somebody would ask me to be their sponsor. God bless them. I heard one fifth step in 17 years. God, thank God that woman's still sober, but I had never been sponsored. I could be giving away anything that I didn't have. I thought I had worked the 12 steps, but I had not had a personal relationship with each of the steps like I have now. And this man was about to take me on that journey, and I am so grateful that he reached his hand back up to me because I was reaching up to him, and he just reached down and pulled me up. And, you know, he gave me my first suggestion, which was call me at work tomorrow. Here's my number. And, you know, I remember calling my mom after this retreat and telling her what had happened, and I knew I was onto something. I felt a surge of power in my life. I knew that God was with me and that I was doing something. I was on the right path. You know, you can kind of feel that when you're doing the right thing. Like, this is good. You need to do this. Like, do it. But by Monday afternoon, I had thought myself out of calling him at work because I have a keen alcoholic mind, and there's a lower power in me that wants to suffer. You know, I want to stay stuck and not change. And I thought my way out of it, and I could justify my thinking in a million different ways. I was like, this guy, you know, back to the old story. Like, he sponsors a ton of people. He only sponsors men. He's too busy. He speaks all over the place. He's got too many sponsees. He doesn't have time for me. Like, just believe in my own lies. And I didn't call him that Monday. And I remember the depression settling back in of like the loneliness and the hopelessness and started to kind of lose the excitement from that retreat. You know, I started to lose that. And Tuesday came and I'm waking up. I'm back in the depression. I'm back in the hopelessness. I'm like, oh, well, at least I'm still sober or whatever. I'm probably never going to have a spiritual experience or whatever. And anyway, that day he called me and that was my first lesson in sponsorship as I see it. And, as I've been taught, you know, that if I don't hear from somebody that I work with, I need to call them. You know, I need to check in on them. That this is a two-way thing. We just entered into an agreement and we're in a relationship now. And I didn't know how to have relationships. Every relationship I ever had sober ended with a lot of drama. You know, just a lot of drama, a lot of bad blood, a lot of like just ugliness. You know, a lot of resentment, a lot of anger, a lot of not forgiveness, you know. And so I did not have relationships. I was scared of people. You know, I really believed that if I got close to you, I would hurt you and then you would hate me. And I just didn't want that. That was part of my being stuck and my illusion about that. Anyway, he asked me, that was a Tuesday. He asked me to come to his home group on Friday. And I did. I came to his home group and the dog met me at the car and barked at me at first and then started wagging and let him know I was okay to come in and meet his family. And I met his family and, you know, he met me on the front porch the first time I came to his house because he didn't know me and he'd worked with thousands of alcoholics and he didn't know what kind of person I was. And he vetted me a little bit before we went in. And that's only significant because, you know, just a few short months later, when I finish my fifth step at his house, he leaves me alone in that house for an hour so I can do my six and seven. And he goes and picks up his kids from school. And I'm part of the family at this point. You know, I've been showing up. I've been doing the work with him. Like we've bonded in a way that's indeed miraculous, right? We've really actually developed a relationship. And he was the first guy to question all my BS that I had about God. You know, I'd call him and say things like, man, I heard that if I wasn't praying to Jesus, you know, my prayers aren't getting to God. Like that sounds legit, right? And he's like, and he's a guy that believed in, that was his religion, you know? And for me to even utter those words to him, just to show him that that's what I was taught, that I didn't know if that was my truth, and I didn't know if I could actually have a real God. And, you know, it was a quick little 10-minute phone call I was having about a sponsee. I was getting gas. I remember exactly where I was. I was just getting gas, and I was telling him this. And his response to me was, you know that's BS, right? And he said BS, the full statement. And I was like, no. He's like, dude, you're an Alcoholics Anonymous. Like, you see miracles all the time. If that were true, none of us would be here. And he started to break away some of these old ideas I had, and he started to show me that not only was God available for me, all I had to do was ask and keep trying and keep seeking. And he that man literally changed my life, and I'm so grateful for him. And he is my buddy. Every time I share a meeting, I text him and say, I shared our story. You know, I mean, he's not my sponsor today. About 4.5 into that years into that experience, I ended up at a women's retreat and I started, somebody suggested that I be a part of it. And I follow suggestions. I'm in the suggestion following business when I can. And I met a group of women and I met my current sponsor who is, you know, they're very similar and they have more time than me, more of the time than me. They got sober around the same time. And she is a solid sober woman of Alcoholics Anonymous that, has really taken that relationship to a different level for me. And I could tell you about that too, but walking through the steps for the first time with Dave, you know, I trusted that he knew how to work the steps. I trusted that I could like let go of some of my fear about giving him all of me in that fifth step, you know, that fifth step experience, you know, I felt the fifth step promises. I felt like, holy crap, I have embarked on this journey for real. Like I told this man all the dark stuff and it was a lot of dark stuff, guys. I mean, it was most of the stuff I had done sober, you know, just a lot of shame, so much self-centeredness, so much, so many living out of old ideas, such a non-principled way to live, you know, a lot of these broken relationships, these things that I had to amend. And when I shared him all that stuff and I gave it all to him like that, it was such a relief to me to realize that, like he had heard it all before. That was such a turning point for me. He had heard it all before. He loved me. I could tell that he loved me even more after hearing my deep, dark crannies of embarrassing things that I had done and humiliating, shameful things that I had done. I could tell by the way he looked at me that we were the same person. And I am, it's such a privilege to be able to be on the other side of a fifth step and to, you know, when you're working with somebody who's really going deep and to be able to say, like, to get it, like, it's always their pain that I relate to. It's not their, you know, their virtues. It's their pain. It's the embarrassing things that they did that I can always relate to. God just seems to put the right people in my life. And when I hear that stuff, I know it. And I started to ascertain for the first time what my real character defects were. I knew I was selfish, obviously, but I didn't know that I had indignation that like I would, you know, that I was so self-reliant and so self-involved that like, I took everything personally, every single thing in my life. If somebody did something like, you know, if somebody did something that made me appear to possibly look bad, I would find that as a personal affront and need to retaliate. I did not know that that was the pattern of my life, that I would fancy to real. I would retaliate when somebody did something I thought was objectionable or questionable, or if they threatened me. Like, I had no humility, zero humility, no ability to soften and be wrong, no ability to, you know, stand my own ground and know my own truth about myself. You know, I was going to learn that later on in the fifth step, you know, coming up with an ideals list. You know, my sex conduct was the place where I had done the most harm. I mean, just, you know, such drama in that arena. And I never really asked myself, like, what do I really want in a relationship? I mean, it says it right on page 69 in the book. It says, we ask God to help shape a sane and sound ideal for our future sex life. I never saw that part. I had never, you know, taken that inventory of, like, who I had sex with, who did I hurt as a result of that relation, you know, what should I have done instead? Like, those questions started to really change the way I viewed about who I'd been in the past. And like, it started to give me a little bit of, like, parameter of, like, who I really wanted to be. And by now I'm praying all the time. I'm like having a conscious experience with a higher power. I'm not even on step 11 yet, but things are already starting to happen. For me in the intuitive department, the sixth sense department. And I remember doing my eighth step with him. It was so magical because, well, not to bore you with too many details, but Dave lived in Annapolis. And I live right in Baltimore City on the west side. And Dave had to speak at a meeting in York, Pennsylvania. So he had to leave his house in Annapolis, drive literally right in front of my building to get on 83 North, drive up to New York for another hour, and come back down and pass my house on the way home. Well, for me to do my eighth step with him, I left my house in Baltimore, drove all the way to Annapolis, got in his car, drove past my house, up to York, back, ended up being like a 4-hour round trip experience, including the meeting. And I literally, as I was leaving his house, like leaving with him in the car going up to York, started on my first note card of the eighth step. And when we were pulling back into his house, into his neighborhood, I read the last one. And what I had done and what I was told to do was, you know, go back through my fourth columns and my sex stuff and the people that I had harmed, but also, like, kind of go through my life again. And, like, there were things that I did when I was drinking. I mean, Sarah and Billy and Greg and I were kind of laughing before the meeting, talking about, you know, people that break into AA meetings on Zoom and act a fool. And I was like, you know, it's kind of just like prank calling to me, feels like. Like, I used to prank call people all the time when I was a little kid. I thought it was so funny to call somebody in the phone book, back when they had phone books, and ask if their refrigerator was running and then tell them to go chase it if they said it was, you know, just, you know, that was what I did for kicks before I started drinking. And, you know, there were things like that. You know, there were things that I stole. I would go to the flea market on the weekends and I would steal from people at the flea market selling junk. Like, just stuff that I was so ashamed of that was just so trifling. Like, it was embarrassing to admit, you know. But there were harms that I had made that had nothing to do with sex or resentments, you know, but just like random harms. And, oh my God, I was a thief. I mean, I shoplifted. Even if I had money in my pocket, I would steal. I just thought I was so good at it that was one of my gifts, you know. And you know, there were things like that, harms that I needed to set right in the universe. And, you know, there were many, many things on that note card. I would write what I did. And on the other side of the card, it was what I thought the amend should be or what I thought the corrective measure would take. And that's what I was reading to him, is what I thought. And then he would filter it with what he thought. And, took a lot of trust, you know, by now I trust him. And, I'm getting some results of doing the inventory and having God in my life. And I'm starting to have some faith that, like, when that one amends, when I said, I think I owe them $3,000, and he said, I think you owe them $5,000, that I just was able to take my pen and cross out three and write five, right? Like, that was all I needed to do in step eight, is just be willing and trust God. And I remember thinking, there's no way I'm ever going to make this amends. There's no way I'm going to have the money to make this amends. There were things on there, like, I had an accountant that didn't feel right, man. She was on my inventory. I just was like, I don't know if she's doing the right thing because I'm not hurting enough. like I feel like I'm self-employed. I should be paying more money. And I would say to her, am I paying the right amount of taxes? Like, I feel like maybe, you know, like, I don't know. It just feels a little, You know, so that went on the list, right? And I ended up having that, the corrective action was let another accountant take a look at your books and be, and if I'm going to be all in, if I'm going to live a rigorously honest life, like I can't cheat on my taxes. I can't be that person, right? And so I started, and the ninth step is when I really found a higher power. I mean, I had a God and I felt like me and God were tight, but in step nine is where God really starts showing off. I mean, showing off big time. You know, I had courage that I would have never had to sit across from someone, and just say, I was so wrong. I'm so embarrassed at my behavior. Like, you know, there was, let me just give you a snapshot of what I look like with untreated alcoholism. I have such ego, right? I think that my time is more valuable than anyone else's, especially when I'm in untreated alcoholism. And, there was a guy that I hired to do a job for me to fix up my trailer that I had crashed into something. He was trying to fix it for me. And this guy's trying to do the job that I hired him to do. And he messages me on Facebook. Thank God it was all on Facebook, because when I went to make the approach to make the amends, I could see the entire conversation and where exactly I had gone wrong and how he asked me to do something. And I thought it was beneath me and my time. So I kind of blew him off and told him, you know, you're the mechanic, figure it out. Like, just arrogant, just this indignant, arrogant, prideful, aggressive energy with this guy. And so he felt that energy and he retaliated, like, all right, man, whatever, you know. And anyway, when I go to pick up this trailer, I end up being locked in his body shop and the cops were on their way and I'm trying to fight him. That is as good as I can get on my own power. And I swear to God, that was me having moral and philosophical convictions galore of what I think a good person looks like and trying to live up to those without God's help. That was as good as I could get. And there were many stories like that. So that guy ended up, he was on the no, I'm never going to make amends to him list when I read that 8-step list. And he ended up being the first guy that I made amends to. And I was sold. I was sold on the God idea. And I'm grateful that it went over well, because Sarah shared an amends story that didn't start off so well. And it has thus ended up, I think, pretty well. But mine, you know, with him, I was so grateful that he was so gracious. I think he couldn't really believe that I just was like, I'm so humiliated. I was such an idiot. I am so sorry. What can I do? My sponsor said, take him for a beer. You know, take him out, meet him at his level. Take him out for a beer or a burger or whatever he wants. And he picked a place and we went and ate. And we ended up talking for hours and I'm at peace with that guy today. And that was, I walked away from that amends going, I want more, because, you know, I'm still an alcoholic and I still like to feel good. So, you know, I start getting relief. I want more. I love that feeling, you know. I don't even realize that I'm really building a sober experience that I can help others with. And I feel like that's the trade-off. You know, that's why God saved me or gave me this opportunity of the sobriety, is that I am supposed to pass it on. And what a gift that is. I did not think that servant was going to be the pay grade that I really wanted. But man, in AA, it is the currency. And my time is the currency. And how much I spend with other alcoholics is what really pays me the most. I had somebody else look at my books, right? I was so afraid of that. So afraid of taxes and, you know, where I was the worst and the most fearful was financially. I just couldn't let God into that part of my life. And I turned my will and my life over to this new accountant. And I started paying taxes. And it's been 7 years, 7.5 years since then. And my business, I can't explain this, but my business has tripled, you know? And I'm paying taxes every quarter. And it scares me every time I write the check that I have, there's this natural fear that's always there, but then there's this sanity returning thing where almost immediately after I feel a fear like that, it's like, oh, you got sober experience to know that God always takes care of you. That's not your job anymore to take care of yourself. Your job is to, you know, that's God's money anyways, none of your business. Like, just keep paying the payroll, put your head down and keep working, write the emails back, show up, take care of the team, be a part of the team. And these are things that, like, I always wanted to be part of a team. But I would go and when I did sports, you know, I was on the loser soccer team with the lamest colors, right? And then, of course, I hated that. Like, you know, the whole team, we sucked. We lost every game. We had brown shorts. We had a yellow shirt. Like, our colors were not good. I mean, they're kind of hip now, but they were not good back then. And we lost every game, and I just didn't want to do it. I was a quitter. And if things were hard, I quit. That is my natural go-to, is to stick my head in the sand and just, like, give up. And what God, having this relationship with Alcoholics Anonymous and you people and the power that you guys bring me, and the God that I have, I've been able to face life successfully. Those third step promises are legit. And I don't think I felt the third step promises until I was way into sponsorship, way into 12. But I started making those amends and, you know, lo and behold, as God does, you know, I was able to sell a painting within 3-4 months of writing that, you know, $5,000 amends down that I was certain I was never going to make the money for. I was able to sell a painting, for enough money to pay for that amends. And I stalked those people online and I found out they divorced and I sent half of it to the husband and half of it to the wife, and the wife really needed it. And it started a conversation with her. And she just recently passed, and I'm so grateful that I had the willingness to take care of that. And her daughter was my run-in buddy, and we were best friends and just did a lot of terrible things together. And I kind of distanced myself from her when I first got sober because she, you know, was drinking in front of me and, definitely was not about being sober and really wanted her drinking buddy back. And I had to kind of let her go. And when her mom died, she's reached out on me on Facebook, and we've been, you know, communicating a little bit that I have one more amends to make down in North Carolina that got canceled this past month because, of this virus and not being able to travel and such. But I was ready to go down to North Carolina and pay for these nitrous tanks that I stole in 1992. you know, it's like my last big amend. And, anyway, I'm going to hopefully see this girl and maybe I can be, you know, a copy of the big book for her. You know, who knows, but we'll see. I'm willing. That's all that really matters. 10 step. Okay. So that'll come in later. I wasn't, you know, I started to turn on with this power, right? I started to get a conscience. I just started to develop a conscience. I started to have parameters of who and what I was. I started to understand spiritual principles. You know, I was being taught all these things. I need to tell the truth. I mean, it says right in how it works, but I would, you know, if really was honesty, who's got time for that? You know, now it's like, dude, I got to be honest. Like, okay, no, can't cheat. You gotta tell the truth, man. This is. You know, if you want to toe this line, if you want to stay here, you got to be living that way. And 11 steps started. And okay, let's enter my new sponsor in. So Dave worked with me for the first 4.5 years. I blow up. I mean, life starts getting amazing. You know, I'm getting asked to speak at meetings. Everybody wants to hear about the girl with 17 years that almost, you know, blew her brains out, because they were so uncomfortable in sobriety to this person who's like super in the work and like active. Everybody wants to hear that story. And it's a gift, man. It was like one of the gifts that I know God is using me, to share that experience with. But I was just like flailing around with sponsorship, and Dave felt so solid at it. Like, he just never got ruffled. He never took things personally. I, on the other hand, had a lot to learn about boundaries. I had a lot to learn about how to be an effective sponsor and how to, you know, curb my time and curb my enthusiasm, because I'll just run myself ragged and throw myself so hard into the work that I, you know, I'm neglecting my family. I'm neglecting my business. I'm neglecting my health. Like, I just don't know how to be balanced. And I enter into this suggestion where I get asked to go to this women's retreat. I meet my new sponsor, and I'm just talking to her outside the parking lot about how to navigate those relationships. And the way she's talking to me and giving me guidance, I just really could hear it in a different way. Same stuff Dave was telling me to do, but I couldn't quite get it because I was resentful at him. I have resented him because he was good at it and I felt like I was bad at it, right? And she started giving me really practical advice, and it turned into a conversation, and she was like, yo, you cannot speak at 4 meetings a week. You could speak at 1 meeting a week. She started to help me like rein it in, because she too is a woman who does too much, right? And so I ended up asking Renee to work, take me through the work, and that has changed my sobriety. It's been amazing. I mean, Dave is, God, he's my man. I love him so much. I got to take a vacation with my mom this past year when we went to Jerusalem, which I had a dream of going to Israel, and she did too, but she wanted to go see the holy sites. And, you know, I'm not scared of that conversation anymore. I'm not opposed to it or offended by it or scared of it. I'm totally open to all spiritual, ideas. And we went on this trip together. No husbands, no wives, just me and her. And I've never spent 10 days with my mom ever. And we went for my 25th sober anniversary and her 65th birthday. And it was an amazing, amazing experience. And I got baptized in the Jordan River with her. It was one of the things she wanted for her birthday. And I said, I got you. I'll do it. Absolutely. I need all the help I can get. Let's do it. And we ended up taking some water from the Jordan River and I brought one for Dave, one for one of my favorite sponsee brothers that I felt he's the one that would ask me questions like, what are you afraid of? And he'd get me to cry. Like he was that guy. He could just get in. He's like my brother. So brought him a bottle and I brought Renee a bottle and I kept one for myself of that experience. And these people are like my family. But with Renee, I've been able to talk to her. I talked to her probably 5 or 6 times a week because I do nightly review with her. That's one of the things that we do together as a sponsorship family and the women that I've and the men that I've sponsored once they get to those steps, we start doing that work together. And I don't do it every night, but I do it enough that we're consistent. She'll call me if she sees something in my inventory that's not right. She'll call me up and be like, hey, I saw something. You know, sometimes I call her just to check in and I'm like, I'm not really sure why I'm calling. Things are really good. And then all of a sudden we just keep talking and something comes out that I needed to really let her see. And it's turned into this arrangement that I'm just such a better person for. And she's just really helped me. I never talked to anybody this much. And because of, you know, the way she sponsors and she sponsors, you know, like somebody with a lot of time that's super active sponsors, you know, got a lot of people to help. And, you know, that moves me into 11 and 12. Like the 12th step is something I thought I would never be able to effectively carry the message and sponsor somebody. And I don't know what that looks like, but I know that I have a sober experience. And so all I have to do is share my sober experience and share my time and Alcoholics Anonymous. And now in our new world that we're in, time is my asset. Time is my currency. And it's funny that I really thought that I didn't have time to sponsor anybody because I'm so busy. I'm just so busy. We're all just so busy. And now it's like I got my knuckles that says make time tattooed on my knuckles. But that was something I told Dave I was going to do when I finished my fourth step. I was like, I think I'm going to get make time on my knuckles. Anyway. Because that's truly what I'm doing in here. I'm making time for these people. And the more time that I see to devote to Alcoholics Anonymous and the work on this realm, the more effective my time is out there, the more energy I have out there. I cannot explain that. It's just one of the millions of paradoxes in AA, but it's like opposite day around here. It's just weird. But truly, the more energy I devote to trying to carry the message to another alcoholic and the more I answer that phone and I get on Zoom and I read stuff with them and I stay in constant contact with them, the better I am. And I have a partner who is not an alcoholic, who's not an AA, who's never ever known anybody in their world, in their life to be an AA, or in recovery or go to rehab. She just has never known anybody except for me. And this relationship has really solidified what I'm doing in here because this person that's not in AA is witnessing the change that happens in me when I give time to the work. Like she would say, go sit in your chair and talk. I'm in my chair. This is the chair I do my 11th step in. Go talk to Jesus or whatever you're doing. Go, you need to talk to your people. How are your sponsees when there's not sponsees coming over? Is everybody okay? You know, like understands that when I say, hey, I got to go get on the phone. I'm going to be on the phone for a few hours. Okay. No big sweat. And I think part of that happened because, Renee suggested that I come to the third step this time around. With my significant other. So they're writing a book, you know, it's better to meet God alone, but you can always do this with your wife, your best friend, your spiritual advisor. I'd never been suggested to do that before. And it was really powerful. And I got to take a third set of prayer with Tess and I read her 60 to 63 and I was explaining like in layman's terms, why I was taking this step and what I was promising in our relationship, you know, going forward, that like, this has to be my life and this is why I'm doing it. And powerful stuff, man. Deep and effective spiritual experiences continue to happen. In my nightly review with my sponsor and my sponsee sisters, and one of the questions is, I mean, we do all the things from the big book, you know, where it was resentful, selfish, dishonest, afraid, just taking a look at that. And there are many days that I don't have a damn resentment. Sorry, I said damn. But there are many days I don't have a resentment. And there are some days I have 4 or 5 resentments. And then it's, you know, did you talk to another alcoholic? You know, where did you see God working in your life? You know, how are you treating, you know, your body, health, food, that kind of stuff? And when I, there's always a correlation with how many resentments I have, how much fear I have, and how many times I'm talking to another alcoholic and where I saw God in my life. It's just when those bottom two are really full, those top four are not very full. It's just, you know, I never thought I would have a scientific mind, but I really am kind of, I treat prayer in the spiritual way of life very scientifically. Like I know from experience, and I know deep to my core that I am really nothing without this power. I've been able to accomplish and do things in my sobriety that there was no way I could have ever done. I mean, I stopped going to school in ninth grade and just started hitchhiking across the country. Like, that's who I am. You know, for me to be able to be consistent and calm and quiet, and a lot of times meet calamity with serenity, I know that has to do with what I'm doing with 10 and 11. You know, what I'm doing to continue to keep that channel open and to keep that conversation with God happening. I sit in this chair every morning. I usually spend about an hour. I try to spend an hour. There hasn't been any 495 traffic for the past few weeks, but I'm still working in Virginia trying to get these couple jobs finished. So I don't have to leave at, you know, 5:30 to make it there by 7. I can leave at, you know, 6 and get there at 7. So I'm being able to sleep in a little bit and spend a little bit more time in the morning. But I literally put my headphones on every morning and I start listening to, I don't usually do guided meditation because I'm still an alcoholic and I can't stand it when somebody tells me what to do. So I usually listen to a song, like sounds. And I get quiet and I ask God, I say the 7-step prayer and the 3rd-step prayer, and I say the 11th step as a prayer. God, you know, please give me the knowledge of your will for me today and the power to carry it out. I like just turn that step into a prayer, and I get quiet. I sit there and I have a pen and paper. Here's what it looks like. Things will come to me. I will get inspiration. I will get an intuitive idea of what I'm supposed to give my assistants to today. You know, what do I need to accomplish today? Something will come up, you know, and I literally rely on it. I rely on that consciousness, with the higher power. But none of it would make any sense, and none of it would hold my interest and keep me as significantly attached to this process as I am if it wasn't for working with others. If it wasn't for getting around alcoholics and listening to, and watching them start to sponsor and listening to them, you know, light up when they're starting to do their step work and they're starting to see parts of themselves that they know they need to change, or when they're, you know, plugging into AA and getting the results, man, nothing confirms what we're doing in here like that. And nothing confirms my experience with a higher power than what I'm doing with that. You know, I still see new things. I still have new awarenesses about who I was when I was drinking. I mean, just going over the first step with a new guy that I'm working with a couple of weeks ago, it occurred to me, and I don't think I've ever had this thought before, that alcohol really did make decisions for me from the very beginning. I started, I mean, at 13, 11, 12, booze is making decisions for me. I think I am totally in control. I think I'm making the decision to go drink that I want to drink, but I wasn't. By then I couldn't wait to Friday night when I could have my lunch money saved up for the whole week, get to the ABC store by the 90, you know, I would hustle the adults to take us to the 99 cent movie theater. But really, we were going to the 99 cent movie theater because it was next to the ABC store and we could hang out in front of the ABC store and wear a short enough skirt and get some guy to buy us a bottle, so that I could go in the alley and drink it. Like, I was already at 12 and 13 years old, I was living that way. And I couldn't wait to do more. I couldn't wait to try it all. You know, and today I'm like, I look forward to, I mean, sometimes I'm tired and I don't want to get on the phone and do a sponsee Zoom meeting. But every time I do, inevitably, every single time I plug into that, I get energized. I don't know what's up with that, other than in God's world, you know, it is not what it seems. There's some spiritual mathematics involved. I just can't explain it, but I'm so grateful for my life in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm so grateful for being asked to do the work. You know, it was a woman in my old home group that suggested that I do another sex inventory. It wasn't even Dave or Renee. It was somebody in, you know, I was still working with Dave, but this was just a woman in my home group with many years sober, you know, a longer time than me. And she said, I think you're a dog, but I know I'm a dog. I think you needed another sex inventory. And my first thought was like, how dare you? I just did a four step. Don't you know? Like, but I'm back to in the dating world and I'm trying to like date by spiritual principles. And like, I am getting myself and I'm attracting the same type of people and I'm being attracted to the same type of people that were on that four step. And she challenged me to do some more work and she took me through the work. It was her and I that did the sex inventory and a lot of old ideas I had about relationships changed. I immediately started, it was so weird. It was so, so weird, but I did the work that she asked me to do right out of the book. I read her the things. She gave me some more assignments because she felt like I needed to go deeper, did those assignments, met her again, read her all those things. And it was like right after that, I started being attracted to a different type of person. It was weird, like older. I was attracted to older people and that had never happened before. And I shared it with my buddy in Connecticut who, I just love this guy. He's a soldier and we're talking on the phone and I told him and he goes, oh, did you do another sex inventory? And I was like, yeah. And he's like, yeah, that happens. You know, you change. I'm like, so sometimes the work I'm doing in here, like I don't see it right away. Like I just suit up and show up. I take the actions that are suggested and I don't see the results of that for months, months later sometimes or years later. I can look back and see, wow, dude, that was really powerful. You know, that was really powerful stuff. It really did change me. And I'm still in awe of Alcoholics Anonymous and all the things that we do here. I'm still in awe that I'm just going through the first four chapters with a new person this week. And I realized for the first time that it asks you to go to the spiritual experience in the back of the book three times in the first four chapters. I never saw that before this week. It was just amazing to be a part of this thing. And I'm so, so grateful for my life. Thank you all for allowing me to speak and paying attention. And thank you, Gary G. I just want to give a shout out to him who has literally driven his car up on some mountain somewhere so that he could get some good signal to make this thing happen. So I just appreciate you all being here and I'm looking forward to question and answers. So thank you and God bless.